before a brief statement. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. I welcome Mildred.
My name is Mildred, and I'm an alcoholic. Mildred Frank, actually. And my dry date is May 18, 1973. I just celebrated my 32nd birthday. And I'd like to tell you that my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous has started here and just gone straight up, easily and seamlessly. You wouldn't believe me anyway, would you? I'm going to tell you my story tonight, what I'm like, what happened, and what it's like now. But I'm at a little disadvantage doing this first because you don't know me. But let me say this, that if I thought that getting sober was tough, I'll tell you something. Learning to have decent, loving relationships, that has been the challenge. If I spiraled down because of my drinking to a park bench, which is what I did, I'd like to tell you, it was all about the booze. And I have to tell you, it was the person I was. And it was the way I saw the world. You know, the Torah says, we see the world not as it is, we see it as we are. And so I'll tell you some things about how I saw the world and how I got to be that way. That's where we're going today in this hour, so I'm going to get right to it. I'll thank the committee tonight and all that good stuff, and thank Anne for, you know, her beautiful hosting, and thank all of you for your warmth. I'll do that at a little greater length because you're quite extraordinary. I came here last night, and oh my God, I just felt blanketed in kindness and love and welcome and all that wonderful stuff. So I have a gift to give to you. Just like when you come to my house, you bring me a gift, or you come to Toronto, you bring us the gift of who you are. And so why did I choose this topic? Well, as I said, I really spiral down because of relationships. And you know, relationship is a hot topic. You have to admit that. People talk about being in a relationship, out of a relationship, as if it's a place. You know, it's got a swinging door, and now I'm in, and now I'm out. Almost, you know. And then there are those who hear relationship and immediately think romance. And that's why I wanted to be sure it was put on the program as relationship, not as relationships. Because relationship is much bigger than romance, and the truth is we're always in relationship. We're in relationship to our parents, to our siblings, to our extended family. I'm in relationship to this room. I'm in relationship with each one of you. I'm in relationship to the floor I'm standing on, I hope. We're in relationship with the people at our meetings, the people in our neighborhoods. We're in relationship with the planet on which we live, the animals, the water we drink, and I could go on and on and on. We're always in relationship because I'm not everything. See, I think it was Teilhard de Chardin who said, eventually, if we do our spiritual work, we come to see that we really are made out of that which is everything, and that we're part of that, and that we really become everything. I'm not at that place yet. I'm still in relationship with things. So I cannot not be in relationship. So how we deal with that is our spiritual practice, I believe. I tried to make my relationships happy. I tried to make them loving, and I didn't have the capacity until I began to see my relationship to you in a different way, saw it in the terms of a spiritual context, and that is truly what I'm here to do, to see you in a different way and to see myself in a different way. And a friend of mine always says, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. See, I had these relationships, mother and daughter, troubled, teacher and student, troubled, boss and employee, troubled, driver and pedestrian. Oh, there's a good one. Driver and other drivers. Farmer and the land. I mean, it goes on and on. We have expectations. We have ideas of how these relationships should be. And it seems to me they just never work out. And so we assign different responsibilities to people and they don't do what we think they ought to do. And I think that's where I got into so many difficulties. You know, I know relationship talk sells. And it seems the more we talk, the more we talk. True? Turn on the television. What are the shows about? Relationship. Go to the bookstore. Go to any section you want. The section that deals with relationship is the big section. And then we have the technology and computers. And they're trying to sell us a world that seems to make the world smaller and us closer together. And I have an awful feeling that they're making us further apart, because all they can present to us is shadows. And it feels as if it's closer together. I need you with skin on. I don't need you separated from me by God knows how many miles. And I think, isn't it really interesting when people start talking about computer dating? Really? I haven't even got a clue what that might mean. Computer, going to meetings on the computer. I don't know about you. I need to be in the room with you at a meeting. I need to look you in the eye. I need to see how you're responding to me, and I need to see how I'm responding to you, not on something that I type out on a computer. I'm not against technology, and I just don't think it can give me what I need in terms of feeling okay. I know people who have almost given up on going to meetings. They say, I do my meetings on the computer, or I do my sex on the computer, or do my dating on the computer. Well, I have a feeling through that process we're not getting the real thing. And sometimes I hope that laughter comes from experience. You wouldn't admit it if it did. You know, and sometimes you just kind of want to say, is there anybody out there? Is there anybody out there? Is there anybody out there with skin on that I can look at, that I can talk to? I know sometimes people become our hair shirts. I realize that. But I still want to be there with you. Now, what did Bill Wilson have to say? That's what really alerted me. When I got sober and I found out, yes, alcohol had spiraled me down, but life took the next chunk out of me. And as I was doing my steps over the years, and as I didn't feel good inside, you know, I'm not saying that I didn't have a lot of good stuff happening, but there was a place deep within me that didn't feel okay. And I began to realize that it wasn't about what was out there. It was about what was in here and how I was relating to what was out there. And I think Bill Wilson knew all about that, because listen to what he says. Quote from the 12 and 12, since defective relations with other human beings have nearly always been the immediate cause of our woes, including our alcoholism, no field of investigation could yield more satisfying and valuable rewards than this one. He goes on to say, we can go far beyond those things that were superficially wrong with us. See, I came into the program, and the things that were superficially wrong with me got taken care of very quickly, didn't they, with you? More or less. But he said, we need to see those flaws which were basic, flaws which sometimes were responsible for the whole pattern of our lives. He goes on to say, it's necessary that we extricate from an examination of our personal relations every bit of information about ourselves and our fundamental difficulties that we can. On another page, he talks about our problems as being our total inability to form a true relationship with another human being. See? So, and I could go on and on. It is from our twisted relations with family, friends, and society at large that many have suffered most. And I have here a copy of what he wrote on emotional sobriety when he was, it was published in the Grapevine in 1958. And the whole thing that he wrote about emotional sobriety was about his dependencies, his relationship to the people and things on the outside, and the struggles that he had with this, and we know about his depressions and all that kind of thing. And he said now he had finally been placed in a place of a quiet place in bright sunshine. And I think it was because he learned to deal with his relationships. In the 12 and 12, in step 10, I nearly fainted when I noticed this the first time. Most of us must admit that we have loved but a few, that we have been quite indifferent to the many, so long as none of them gave us trouble, and as for the remainder, well, we really disliked or hated them, right from the 12 and 12. And that described me, and I really didn't understand what was wrong because I had so many false ideas. I think that the problem really is a case of mistaken identity. You know, yesterday when Anne came to the airport, she wanted to make sure that she had my identity straight so that she brought the right person. I don't know if you've heard this story. I've heard this story about the person who was picked up at the airport. He was going to an AA conference. And as they were driving to the hotel, the two men who picked him up were chatting about the party that they were having that night. And, you know, it was a big cocktail party, and they were going to be drinking, etc. And he said to himself, well, this is unique. I thought I was going to an AA function. So he said, where are we going? And it turned out that through some fluke, they had picked up the wrong person. And these were businessmen who were going indeed to a party as was appropriate to them. So, you know, being sure you have the right identity is really important. You know, down through the ages, if you look, we've always been told, wake up. What does that mean? If you're asleep, what does that imply? And even in the big book in step 12, what does it say? As the result of doing these steps, you're going to wake up spiritually. You're going to wake up to the fact that there's another dimension. I didn't know that. I thought you were out there to fix my life. I thought that was your job. If you were my mother or my father or my teacher, my priest, whoever you were supposed to be looking after me. And it turns out that that perhaps isn't the way it is at all. Because the book says we're going to wake up spiritually, and if we're going to wake up, the implication is we've been asleep. Isn't that true? What happens when you're asleep? You miss what's going on around. If you were in this room, it wouldn't matter if I were offering $1 million bills or if I were saying I'm going to hit you. If you were asleep, you wouldn't be aware of that. If you're asleep and you're in a good dream, you still have to wake up to the reality of that which is. And I'll tell you, relationships are raw, and they're real, and they're challenging. That's the way I see it. The good dream, I can dream, I'm married to this wonderful man, and then I have to wake up and find out that I am alone. I always tell the guys I give retreats to, I'm taking resumes. And I get some, too. I can be asleep, and I can have a bad dream. See, it's all about being asleep. And the ancients have said, wake up. What are they saying? You miss out on the enjoyment of what it is to be in the real world, as Bob talked about so beautifully this morning. The book says God wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. And I can tell you that I was not happy, joyous, and free, not the way I thought that was to be interpreted. See, I thought that meant that I was supposed to have fun. You know, I look at the people that I know today, and some of them are having fun. But there are people I know who are happy, joyous, and free, who are happy, joyous, and free because of the great fact. Their relationship with God is right, and because their relationship with God is right, their relationship with themselves is right, and their relationship with others is right, and so they're happy, joyous, and free, though they may be dying of cancer. We buried one of my sponsees last summer, and the last time I took her to lunch, you know, she was in very bad condition. You know, the last thing she said to me, you know, Mildred, I've made a pact with God that every moment that he gives me on the planet, I'm going to enjoy it just as much as I can. What a message. She got it, that God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. But how do I do that? I have to live with you. And I used to think you were a bunch of crapheads. You know, I'm an ex-nun. I shouldn't say crapheads, should I? Well, you know, I went to a convent because I thought I was going to get spiritual. And if I got spiritual, then I could deal with all of you because I didn't like you. Didn't like you right from childhood on. And I certainly didn't like you any better as I became an adolescent, and I sure didn't like you any better as I became a young adult. And so I'm going to become spiritual, and God and I will have this. That'll make life okay. You know, that dream, it got blown wide apart. Because today I know that if I cannot live with you in peace and love and care about you, I'm missing the boat, because I think that's all it's about. It is about relationship. It is about being able to look you in the eye and say, I care about you. I don't have to like you. You know, I have to love you. I have to be able to see the God presence that is in you like it is in myself. And then I don't have to like what everybody does, just like you don't have to like what I say. You don't have to like everything that I do. But if you're trying to live this kind of spiritual life, you do have to love me. You do have to recognize. And I think that's a word that we have abused. You know, some languages have 50 words for love. We have one. I love my dog. I love spaghetti. I love the weather. I love this, that. I love my boyfriend. I love God. I love spirituality. I love AA. We use one word. I think there's a big difference between love, because love is a decision to make a commitment to something. It's not about whether I like you or not. And getting back to that idea of identity, if somebody gave you an egg beater and said, this is a cement mixer, and you mix cement with it, you'd ruin the egg beater, wouldn't you? Because you're using the egg beater for that which it wasn't made. And you could go try and clean that up and do it again, and you'd keep doing the same thing. That's what I did with relationship. I didn't know what you were in my life for. I thought you were here as my personal play children. You know, you were supposed to fix me, etc., etc. What if you took a handset from a telephone and you thought it was a hammer, and somebody said, just, you know, you can use that to hammer? You'd smash it, wouldn't you? Because you're using it for that which it wasn't given. And I don't think that my life was given to me so that I could walk through the world and hate you and judge you and criticize you. And all the great masters have said, including the great teacher, do not judge. And you must forgive people because you will be forgiven to the extent that you forgive others. How is that possible when we live on a planet with everything going on? You know, and if you tell me you like everybody, keep living a while. So, I think it was the ancients. They knew who we were. They knew we were God seekers. And I think that's why I'm an alcoholic. I'm a God seeker. The other part of me is that I have that body. You ever hear an alcoholic come into the program who says, I just felt so good. You know, I just had such a great childhood and everything just went so well with me and I just took a drink and, you know, it just carried me into alcoholism. More likely you will hear, I didn't feel right. I didn't fit. Somehow or other, I didn't fit on the planet. I felt I should be in another family. Anybody identify with that? Even the Al-Nons may identify with that. You know, and Carl Jung, what did he say? You know, Bill Wilson called him one of the co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what does he say? He said, yes, I knew about Roland Hazard, that what he was seeking was union with God. That was the language of his day. We would say spiritual awakening. He was seeking union with God, but he said, you know, about this separation, and he said, I couldn't say that because my colleagues were already becoming suspicious of me. What did Dr. Silkworth say? He says, we're restless, irritable, and discontent. And I would say we're angry, controlling, manipulative, worried, you know, despairing, and all kinds of things until we can again get ease and comfort from taking a few drinks. What if I could get ease and comfort in another way? What if I could get ease and comfort through my spiritual practice of relating to you? Now, there's a piece of work. See, and that's why he said, we need an entire psychic change. I think that's just amazing. Not just a little bit. You know, the ancients always said, they talked about metanoia. Change your mind. What did Bill Wilson say? Human power can't fix it. He said human power can't help you with your alcoholism. There is no middle-of-the-road solution. That is what the book is about, to help you find the power bigger than yourself so that that power will solve your problem. I already talked about what he said about the emotional dependencies that kept him in pain, in major pain, and he was the co-founder. I pay attention to that because he said, what was it? It was his dependencies on stuff on the outside. And then there's that wonderful saying that that statement from page 164. Be sure that your relationship with God is right, and great things will come to pass for you and countless others. And I can't believe, personally, that it's all right for me to hate you. I can't believe that anymore. I can't believe it's all right for me to judge you. I can't believe it's all right for me to criticize you. I've got to find another way to see the world so that I can look at you, and even though I may not like you, I can love you and wish you well. That, to me, is the solution that we're looking for. So, you know, I love when scientists, you know, in the chapter to the agnostics, Bill brings in the idea of science. And I love when the scientists are saying the same thing that our spiritual leaders are saying. And what did Einstein say? He says, it's an optical delusion that we're separate. And he ended that passage by saying, our task, this is Einstein talking now, not Mother Teresa. Our task must be to widen our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures. That's Einstein. Schrödinger was a man who won a Nobel Peace Prize, and this is what he said. He said, we believe that what we do say, think has no effect on the physical world. He said, it's not true. If we continue to believe we're separate, we will suffer as individuals, as cultures, and we will suffer in our relationships. Let's just take that last statement. If I continue to believe that I'm separate from you, then I will suffer in my relationships. And isn't, like, we look at the golden rule. What is the golden rule really saying? It isn't a self-serving thing. Well, I'm going to be good to you so that you'll be good to me. It is kind of the way it happened, but that's not, I think, what the basis of the golden rule is. The basis of the golden rule is that you and I are one, and what I do to you, I do to myself. Now, there's a principle by which to live in a relationship. Capra was another man who won a Nobel Peace Prize, and this is what he says. The quantum physics forces us to see the universe as a complicated web of interrelationships between the various parts of the whole. I have to tell you, there was a day when I could have stood at this podium and I would have seen you as separate from me, and I'm here and I'm going to tell you something and then I'm going away, and then you'll be here and I'll be back in Toronto. I don't see that today. I see you as part of myself. And what you do affects me, and what I do affects you. And the energy that we share is the healing, indeed, that we experience. And then there's another scientist. He hasn't got his Nobel Peace Prize yet, but I expect he'll get it. And this is what he said. We belong to something bigger and greater than ourselves. This is a scientist talking. We belong to something bigger and greater than ourselves. Can I believe that there are 6.5 billion of us on the planet, and that I should be in the middle of it judging everybody, that it's all right for me to hate you, and because you don't do what the way I think, that it's okay for me to judge and criticize and hate and all that kind of thing? It makes no sense. And the scientists see that, and he says, we belong to something bigger and greater than ourselves, which is forever unfolding and evolving. And within that dynamic creative process, we rediscover again and again the meaning and purpose of what life is about. Dr. David Hawkins says this, the universe waits with bated breath to see every choice that we make, because every choice that I make goes out there into the race consciousness, and one way or another affects how you are and how the whole world is. So I love when the scientists are, you know, saying the same thing. I think this is the situation, that we come in a two-in-one package. Oh, my God, that might go so fast. You know, many years ago, Chuck Chamberlain was my teacher. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous the first time in 1966, but I just couldn't live sober. You know, Laurel talked last night about the fact that, you know, she just couldn't handle not being having something in her that was going to change the way she felt, and that was me. I came into AA. I was in Prince Albert at the time, and they sure told me the truth, but I couldn't pull it off, so I sat in AA stoned, and I'm not proud of that. But at the time, Chuck Chamberlain used to come out. Do any of you know Cece Corrigal? Yeah, some of you, a few of you do. I saw Cece in February. He's 52 years sober now. He was one of our trustees for a while. And I understand he's not well. I'm still hoping that he'll be joining us in Toronto for the international. By the way, how many of you are joining us in Toronto for the Wow, that's great. That's wonderful. Anyway, Chuck Chamberlain was a friend of Cece, and so Chuck used to come to Prince Albert a lot. And anybody that came to town got a crack at me, see if they could tell me something that would smarten me up. And Chuck used to sit with me, and he used to draw that diagram. And my eyes would glaze over, of course, and he'd say, thank God he'd read the book. He said, you know, Mildred, God is everything. That's all there is. What does that mean to you when you're stoned? Yeah, right. And then he'd draw that picture, and it's in his book, The New Pair of Glasses. Not really his book. It was a retreat that he gave that was transcribed into a book. And he used to say, you already are everything that you can be. Well, if God is everything, and I'm here and I'm part of that, then I guess I am everything I can be at some level. And he'd say, you already know everything that you can know. And then he'd laugh. And if you knew Chuck, he'd go, hee-hee-hee-hee-hee-hee. And that was Chuck's laugh. And you knew that, you know, he wasn't laughing at you. He was laughing because he understood that one day, perhaps, I would get the bigger picture and I would see that. And now I thank God that I sat at his knee. How many times, and he drew that picture, and he said that to me. God is everything there is. And one day, I don't know, I guess I was about 25 years sober. I saw that in the big book. I was in my car, and I saw that. The day will come when, faced by a self-imposed crisis, you will have to face either God is everything or God is nothing. What is your choice going to be? See, some of this stuff doesn't make sense to the intellect. God is everything. I don't understand it with my intellect, but my heart does. And I think that's why when I love the ocean, don't you? I love to stand by the ocean, and I'll tell you when I stand by the ocean, I don't want to talk. It's too big. It's too wonderful. You know, one of the great teachers, Joseph Chilton Pierce, says, we only need 10% of our brain cells to learn stuff that'll help us be good human beings. But he says that to wonder, W-O-N-D-E-R, he said that's what the 90% is about. So that we can look up at the stars, that we can look up the beautiful sunsets, that we can look at the aurora borealis, all things which I did as a child, and I couldn't figure out why there was so much incredible beauty in the world, and there was so much pain in people, namely in my sister Dora, who was retarded, and I'll talk about that tonight. So, that's fine. You know, all right, there we are. We're part of God, and I look at you and I say, I hate you. How does that work? Well, one day when I was meditating, that picture came to me, because I think the book really tells us this, too. It says, deep down within every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It is only there that he may be truly found. But the fact remains that on this experience on the planet, we live in a body, and there we're smack into relationship, aren't we? Because, and I think for me, that has solved a lot of what I struggled with. Because I didn't differentiate that. And I, like people, would say, well, they go to church and they're mean. Or they go to AA and they don't practice these principles in all their affairs. Ever said that? Well, you see, I think there's a place in us that is perfect and whole and complete. How else are you going to interpret what the book says? Deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. That life force that you can't see with these physical eyes, but that it's there. And that's what we're to express. Take a look at the prayer of St. Francis. What does he say in that prayer? See, he says, he's acknowledging there's pain in the outer world. There's pain and darkness and unforgiveness and all kinds of things. But the light is within me, and it's my choice whether I'm going to add to the darkness or whether I'm going to bring the light and the love and the beauty and the goodness that is within us. Isn't that what AA is all about? If you look at the 12 steps, isn't that what we're really doing? We start out with the idea that I'm not the boss, and then we go through that whole business and take a look at how we have lived on the planet. And isn't it always about our relationships? If you take a look at your fourth step, if I take a look at mine, that's what it's about. It's about what I thought you should do for me and what you weren't doing for me. And the result was I hated you and all the acting out behavior. And then the drinking of the alcohol fixed it all, it seemed, for a little while. It made the pain go away and I spiraled down until there was nothing left. You know, ex-nuns can sleep on a park bench too. Ex-nuns can, they don't get trained for that, by the way. They don't teach you how to do that. But if you keep drinking enough alcohol, and if you live the way I lived, and you think the way I thought at that time. See, I had studied theology and philosophy. I didn't know any of that. I believe today that this great power lives in you as it does in me. You may be asleep to it, and if you are, you may do things that don't suit me. That's fine. I can still see the great power in you. And when we do that, and I think that's one of the beauties of Alcoholics Anonymous, we know that everybody in AA isn't walking around with a major halo on their heads, right? Maybe they do in Tallahassee. They don't in Toronto, probably. We still have our flaws. But we know that there's something bigger than ourselves. And that's what Bill said. That's what the book is about, to help us find the power greater than ourselves, which will solve our problem. Now, as I said, I think the fly in the ointment is this. We come here in this two-in-one package. We come with the body, and we come with the spirit. And what do we pay the attention to? Do we pay attention to the growth of the spirit? Step 11 brings us to the point where it says that's what it's about. It's not about asking for stuff for ourselves. It's not about asking that our lives go any particular way. It's about asking that we can know God's will and that we have the power to carry that out. When the great teacher was here, what did he say? He said, you people have it all wrong. He said, you're spending all your time on the stuff which doesn't last. And I think that could apply in the year 2005. We spend a lot of time on the stuff which doesn't last. How often did I used to say, I don't have time to meditate. I don't have time to do spiritual reading. I don't have time. I'll talk to God in the car. Yeah, right. Do you have a love affair in the car? Well, maybe you do. I don't know. Where does it all start? See, I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous because I want to get to something practical. But, you know, I debated, should I talk about this stuff? But that's the stuff that changed me, seeing this thing different. Because as long as I looked at you as human, and as long as I said, I'm only human, I was in trouble in relationship. And I have to say, you know, my relationships are loving today. And something has been able to be changed because I'm no longer looking at you as just a human being out there, somebody that should be making me feel good. Because if I'm looking the right way, there's a part of me that's whole and complete now, just like the part of you is whole and complete. And we dance in these bodies. And if all we pay attention to is the body, we're going to be thinking that it's about stuff, and it's about getting stuff and controlling people and getting people to act the way I want them to and all that, and that's the way I lived. And at 21 years, I came into a real crisis place. I had the good life. I was a good member of AA, but there was still something not at peace within me. Another surrender was required. And that's when somebody took me and read to me something that Bill Wilson had written. And I said, you shouldn't be reading that to me. That sounds like Freud. And, you know, Dr. Bob said we should keep these Freudian complexes out of our lives. It wasn't written by Freud. It was written by Bill Wilson, right in step 8 in the 12 and 12. And this is what he said. Very deep, sometimes quite forgotten, damaging emotional conflicts persist below the level of consciousness. At the time of these occurrences, they may actually have given our emotions violent twists, pretty strong language, which have since discolored our personalities and altered our lives for the worse. In one of his letters to the man who really was his spiritual director, I guess, Father Ed Dowling, the Jesuit in St. Louis, he talked about the fact that he had taken hits in childhood. And don't get nervous. I'm not talking about issues and boundaries. I'm talking about where the problem really sits. And he defined it right here. He said to Father Ed Dowling, that he had taken hits in childhood. And his conclusion from these experiences with his mother were that he better be number one, because that's the only way his life could be okay. I took hits in childhood, just like everybody does. You know, when I work with people these days, I always tell them, if you're having trouble in relationship, get to know who you are. Because I found out that the child I was the woman I had become. The child that I was had never, this is the way I thought as a child. Nobody loves me. Nobody listens to me. I'm always left out. Life is scary. I'm not important. I should have been a man. Ah, there's a thought. And you should fix this. I can't fix it. I've got this retarded sister. I can't fix it. I'm only a little girl. But if you cared about me, you'd fix it. You've got your stories. Bill had his. He called it taking hits. And when I acknowledged what had happened, not to sit and whine about it and blame people and all that stuff. I don't believe in that. We've got to stand up and be counted, because that's who I think we are, and that's how I've got to live, responsible to the God within me. And that's why on page 164 it says, be sure that your relationship with God is right. And if you are part of that God, then I can't have a relationship with God unless I'm okay with you. And that's where the deal comes in, you see. Because what happens is that we bury these old ideas. I give retreats a lot of the weekends of the year. I'm sure that I encounter some hundreds of people in the course of a year. And I hear it day in and day out. That becomes the work. You know, the old ideas that we have. And we say, oh, well, that doesn't matter. Oh, yes, it does. I've seen people who have sat there with two PhDs who are very important in their field of endeavor, who go to work every day because they believe they're going to be fired. See, we think we run our lives with the intellect. I know now where the answer is. It's in my heart. What does the big book say? You know, after Dr. Silkworth, in the doctor's opinion, very clearly talks about the allergy we have. And once we put the alcohol in, the allergy kicks in and we have that terrible craving, so that after 50 drinks, we want the 51st. We've already got our teeth kicked out, but we need some more booze. In the chapter, there is a solution. What does Bill write? Doesn't say the main problem is in the body. He says the main problem rests in the mind. You see, look at me. This was where is the mind? Not the intellect. See, for years, I ignored that statement because I thought, I'm smart. I've been to university. I've done this, da-da-da-da-da. I thought it was my intellect. And one day, one of the old-timers took me aside and said, you got this wrong. That's not where the problem is. It's in your inner world. The values and the beliefs and the old ideas and all that stuff inside. Dr. Paul Olliger, he used to make fun and he'd talk about the committee. Anybody identify with that? That's what he was talking about, those old ideas that get stirred. Some of you are smiling, just remembering. But when those old ideas get stirred, it's not a smiling matter, is it? Because many of us, you know, we don't know what to do with that stuff. Well, you know, here's me. I'm smart, I'm well-educated, and I'm wrecking my life. I wind up on a park bench because the energy I'm putting out is a false energy. Nobody loves me. Nobody listens to me. Life is scary. I don't matter. You should fix this, and you don't, and therefore I hate you. And you can't get away from that. And you know why I need you? For two things. I need you for two reasons, like you need me for two reasons, I think. I used to hear this, and I didn't understand it. I do now. You're the mirror through which I see myself. God has sent people into my life that I have hated bitterly, my mother being one of them. You know why I hated her? Because I saw myself in her. That's why I hated her. God sends us people. I think that's the way the universe works. That's what relationship is about. You're in my life for a very specific reason. I don't always know the reason. God does. But you're doing one of two things. You are either holding up the mirror to me so that I can see who I am, or you are triggering stuff that is unloving, that's part of the problem, and that I need to release. And that, to me, is what it really is all about. And that's why I think sometimes when you see people, their life looks so good on the outside, isn't it true? And they go and drink. Or you see people like me whose life is so good on the outside. You know, after I got off Skid Row, I got, you know, I'll talk about it tonight, but I made lots of money. I had a big house, da-da-da-da-da-da. And on the outside, everything was so good. I was liked in AA, you know, I had sponsees, I was sponsored, etc. But I was dying inside. You know, there it is. Be sure that your relationship with God is right, and great things will come to pass for you and countless others. That's what I think relationship is about. It's about the healing of those old wounds. Because once those old wounds are healed, I think we begin to see how easy life can be. Then the dream is, we're no longer in the dream. We're in the real world. We're seeing the world the way it is. And that includes what I said. I think life is raw and it's real. It's unpredictable. And that's when you begin to realize that you are in the hands of God, and that it is all being worked out when we give up. See, all this stuff that I've been talking about is really the talk of the false self, isn't it? In step three, it says, I've got to be rid of self. And it says, I can't do it by myself. I need you. My walls came tumbling down when I was 21 years sober. And that's when the real changes in my life, when I began to be able to let you in, and when I was able to let down my masks and my pretenses and be who I am, for good or bad. You know, I sat there last night and I sat there this morning and I thought, do I want to take the risk of really saying what I think about relationship? You know, and that's what it is. This is what I really believe. I'm just going to take a few minutes to talk about a few specific relationships. I know we're going to listen to the delegate at 2:30, and I'm very excited to do that. But I think there are a couple of relationships that were troublesome to me, that I have learned some things about that I'd like to share with you. See, again, I used to think that people were in my life and they should be a certain way. And nobody seemed to fill the bill. First of all, parents, oh my God, they sure blew it. It was, you know, if they hadn't been the way they were, then I wouldn't be the way I am. And I have to tell you, I don't believe that today. And I think it's really important that we make peace with our parents. You know, the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can justify every sentence that I've said up here, because it may not be said in the same words that I'm using, but it's in there. It says in step 4, we're not saying that what they did was right. We're just saying, it's not my stuff. And don't let me make it my stuff. If you do something, if you choose to gossip about me, or whatever it is that you choose to do, that's not my stuff. That's your stuff. What am I going to do about that stuff? How am I going to handle that? And I love that statement in the book. I go back to that often. You know, we're not saying that what they did was right. We're just saying it isn't my stuff. I'm here to grow spiritually. Otherwise, I think Alcoholics Anonymous makes no sense. I think it's about a lot more than not picking up a drink. It's that, absolutely. I'm not saying that. But what am I going to do with that sober life? As Bill starts out here, I think many oldsters who put our AA booze cure to severe but successful tests still find they often lack emotional sobriety. Perhaps they will be the spearhead for the next major development in AA, the development of much more real maturity and balance in our relations with ourselves and with our fellows and with God. That's how he starts the article and ends it with, after he's talked about his dependencies, saying, I have been given, my brain no longer races compulsively. In either elation, grandiosity, or depression, I have been given a quiet place in bright sunshine. See, I think we all come here to do our dance. I'm in this body for a reason. It's my spacesuit. Let me not make the mistake that the spacesuit, there's no, you know, none of your astronauts is out there, you know, putting on the spacesuit thinking the spacesuit is him. That's not who I am. It's just the body that I'm in for now. And I don't believe that you, your spacesuit is you. You're something other than that. And we're here to do our dance together so that we can relate to each other. You know, I was so hard on my parents. Oh, my goodness, I was so hard on them. And, you know, I think that this is our most fundamental relationship. And until we heal, we're going to have serious problems in relationship with others. We're going to have major unfinished business. Doesn't mean what they did was right. Just, they were in my life for a reason. And if I can't let them go, somebody said to me, that will leak into every relationship, especially marital. And I'm standing here to tell you, I had 3 major relationships with men, and my relationship with my mother leaked into every single one of those relationships. Yeah, I just have an hour, so I can't go into detail, and you're probably saying, thank God for that. Anyway, what must change is my relationship to myself, how I see the world. And who were my parents? You ever think about what your parents were? Like, how can parents give what they haven't been given, or who they're not? And I have to take responsibility. You know, people have been talking about coming from Catholic families. So did I. There were 10 big ones in our family. And I was the last of the 10. If I were to tell you about my relationship with my mother, my brothers and sisters, they just, at one time, I didn't know that they didn't see her the same way I did. And I said something about my mother, and there was just dead silence in the room. They didn't relate to her at all the way I did. And yet we lived in the same house. We had the same social standing. We were treated basically the same. And yet there I am with this big ball of dislike, especially toward my mother. You see? And the way I was raised, how many times did I say, "You made me angry"? Anybody ever say that? If you squeeze a tube of Preparation H, nobody here does, of course, but if you squeeze a tube of Preparation H, what do you expect is going to come out? Preparation H, I hope. Probably isn't going to be cake icing that comes out. And why? Because that's what was in the tube in the first place. And if life squeezes on me and anger comes out, it's not because you squeezed on me, it's because that's what was in me in the first place. I learned to blame. You were wrong. The Pope was wrong. Mother Superior was wrong. My university professors were wrong. My friends were wrong. My brothers and sisters were wrong. And if you would change, I'd be okay. And what I didn't know was I was listening to those old messages. You're not okay, you're a girl, you know. Oh, my goodness. My mom and dad. You know, one day I realized. I heard a story about my grandmother. My grandmother was a tough little bird. She was an American, by the way. Not that that means anything. But I remember an incident. And she was a wiry, tough little bird. And one day it came to me. I wonder if she had the capacity, if my dad was crying when he was a little boy, I wonder if she ever had the capacity to take him in her arms and say, "You're my little boy. I love you so much." My father grew up stern, and he was somewhat rigid. Why would he not be? Then I found out where my mother, what her history was. And I began to see the world. And it doesn't, you know, I still was impacted by the way I interpreted that. But I was able to let my parents be who they are and to see that the gifts I got, the gifts were enormous. I got a great body from them. I got a great mind. I saw them live with integrity. I saw them live with discipline. I saw them work hard. Yeah, my father never, you know, put his arms around us and said, "I love you so much." But I'll bet you that if I'd gone to my father and said, "You never did that, you didn't love me," I bet he would have cried. He would have said, "But you know, I worked 16, 17, 18 hours a day to put food on the table and see to it that you got nice clothes and that you had an inheritance," and on and on and on. You know, the words, that isn't the way people lived in those days. And I saw how they lived with generosity. Our house was always open. What about children? I don't have children. But I was a teacher, and I learned something in dealing with those students that I had. I learned to tell the truth about myself. Instead of ragging on them, I'll tell you one quick story. One time we had some guests coming into the school, and so these were high school students, but emotionally disturbed adolescents. The biggest one was at the front of the room. And I had threatened them with hellfire if they did not act properly. And they didn't act properly. So when they came back to the room, hellfire descended. And I, you know, told them what was going to happen, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I went home not feeling good. I knew that it was not about them. It was about me and my bad temper. And I didn't understand it at the time, but I know now what it really was about. And God gave me enough insight that I was able to go back to school the next day and say to those kids, I have to talk to you about yesterday. And, you know, they were appropriately shamefaced. And I said, not what you think is coming. I said, I have to tell you the truth about what happened yesterday. What really was going on yesterday when you misbehaved was I was feeling bad about myself. Because when you misbehaved, it wasn't about your misbehavior. What I was hearing was they don't care about me. They don't respect me. Because if they did respect me, see, here's my interpretation. If they did respect me, they would behave in a certain way. They would have done what I asked them to do. I told on myself what was going on inside. And I saw the faces lighten, and they said, oh, miss, that's not true. We love you. It's an amazing thing what happens when you tell people the truth about what's going on in here, as is appropriate, of course, you know. And it's amazing, the response. Because they knew, somewhere in their souls, they knew that it was not about their behavior, that it was something about me that I was laying on them. And the bonds we forged were unbelievable. You know, I think if we don't do that, there's a lot of background noise. And it's never about what's on the surface. And if we leave that background noise going, we're not going to hear the music in their lives. We're not going to see the beauty of the people that we deal with. This is about freedom, you know. If you can see them as whole and perfect now, oh, you know, I wrote enough stuff, we could be here all day. I just want to say one more thing about love relationships. I made the mistake with every relationship that I had, thinking that I was not okay and I needed a man to make me okay. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands about that one. That's very personal. But I've been through it, and I can say it. Because I know now that I felt like a nothing. And I felt I'm a girl, I'll never amount to anything, and the only way that I'll ever have a place in the world is if I find a man who's rich and who's good-looking and who's popular and who cares about me, and then we'll be one, and then I'll have a place because I'm one with him. That's right. Well, it didn't work that way. I can tell you, I paid a price for that. Because that's not what the universe allows you to do. I've got to learn to stand up and be counted, not because I'm a man or because I'm a girl, but because God lives in me and live from that place of respecting myself and knowing that life will be okay. Be sure that your relationship with him is right. I paid a price. You see, when you fall in love, or heat, the hormones flow. And Freud said we get 90 days of socially acceptable insanity. And that's kind of the way it is. If you look at the statistics show that now, I don't know about your country, you may be just in the same state we are, over 50% of all marriages end in divorce. And in shorter and shorter period of time, and some of the older marriages these days. And it also shows that people, years ago when people had second marriages, those marriages were often successful. In our country, I think the statistic is now that 50% of those also, you know, break up because people don't do the changing, still think there's somebody out there. The first, you know, and I could go through this whole rigmarole. The first man, got rid of him. He was a psychiatrist. bad news. Another, second man, third man, it was the same deal. I'm going to be okay. And after the third one, then I was in major change. I know there's nobody out there going to make me okay. See, if you go into a relationship thinking, I'm not okay, and if he buys me the right amount of roses, or if he says the right things, or if he does, or if you're the man, and you say, if she does this, this, and this, then I'm going to be okay. You're asking for the impossible, because really only God can make things okay. I am whole and complete. So what happens in a loving relationship? We make a safe place where we can live out that, where we can practice being loving beings. When it's all said and done, and I'll close, I think that what we're here, and I think the model of it is the prayer of St. Francis. I think we're here to practice being God beings. And through relating to one another, I find out where I'm anything but a God being. And then I get to correct it. I get to change it. I get to ask God for help. And then I can have loving relationships. Thank you so much for the opportunity of being here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Can we close in the usual?